Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hello, friends and neighbors. Welcome to the Bill Press Pod and today's special guest, Congressman John Yarmuth. In 1996, reflecting the uncertainty of that time, President Bill Clinton famously said, "The era of big government is over." Well, he actually hasn't said it yet, but by his actions in 2021, reflecting the needs of this time, President Joe Biden has in effect announced, "The era of big government is back, big time." Biden's $2 trillion physical infrastructure package, coming on top of his $2 trillion stimulus and a soon-to-be-announced $2 trillion human infrastructure plan, has been called the biggest and the boldest public investment initiative since the days of FDR. Of course, announcing big proposals is one thing. Getting them through Congress, even a democratically controlled Congress, is another. And after Speaker Nancy Pelosi, nobody will play a more important role in steering President Biden's legislation through Congress than Congressman John Yarmuth, chair of the House Budget Committee. So can Democrats round up enough votes in the House and Senate? Let's ask the good congressman. Congressman Yarmuth, good to talk to you, and thank you for joining us here on the Bill Press Pod.
Thanks, Bill. It's great to be with you.
I want to start with some recent breaking news. President Biden saying that 20 years in Afghanistan, we had achieved whatever we could achieve, and it's time to bring all American troops home. Did he do the right thing?
Oh, I think he did. As it is said very often, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over, expecting a different result. And that's what we've been doing for the balance of those 20 years. But even more so than that, I mean, the people, if you remember, those people who remember Charlie Wilson's war and think back to the Russian experience in Afghanistan and how disastrous that was for them and frustrating. So, you know, we probably should have learned something from that experience. We didn't. And I certainly think the last 20 years kind of echoed that that Russian experience. It's just a country that you can't accomplish much as a foreign influencer. So I think he did the right thing. I would have supported it if Obama had done it. I would have supported it if Trump had done it. So I'm glad that Joe Biden has finally decisively done it.
And one of the biggest challenges certainly now facing the congressman, and particularly with your role as the chair of the Budget Committee, Congressman, is the infrastructure bill, or as the White House calls it, the American Jobs Act, $2 trillion worth of improvements or public investment. What are the chances in the House? Any Republican votes at all, do you see?
Oh, I doubt it. It's amazing how people's positions change on things when they're not the party in power. And I say that for both parties. We were very big on the filibuster during the Trump years. We're not very big on it right now. This is something that, strangely enough, Republicans are so much on the wrong side of the country on this, and it's just kind of, in a way, it's humorous, in a way, it's gratifying to hear them grasp for arguments against it. Mm-hmm. The notion that only 5% of this is infrastructure, because it's only 5% for roads and bridges, which is not accurate, by the way. There's $600 billion, or roughly a third of the entire package, is for conventional infrastructure. But the idea that Republicans don't think that the electric grid is infrastructure, that broadband's infrastructure, that electric charging stations aren't infrastructure, that an affordable system for child care and senior care is not part of infrastructure, is just a 19th century view of the country. And it just is not relevant to today's world. As I've said on many occasions the last few weeks, if a woman can't get to her job because she can't find affordable care for her kids or for a parent or grandparent she's taking care of, then that's just as much of an impediment as not being able to take public transportation. So, again, we just need to rethink, and we are, and I think the Biden administration has rightly defined infrastructure in a much more expansive way, and I think that's appropriate. So I'm thrilled with the package. When I heard about it the first time and they briefed us and went through it point by point, I said, wow, this is such a coherent plan. It all makes sense together. And with the underlying theme of doing something that will help with climate change, and I just think it's truly could be a transformative package for the country, and I look forward to passing it. It's not going to be easy, but next few months will tell.
But in conversations with your Republican colleagues, they have to have projects, roads, bridges, sewage treatment plants, or whatever in their districts that they know need updating or repairing or fixing, right?
I mean, of course. And what's, again,
so what do they tell you about that?
Well, they just don't right now. Well, first of all, the corporate tax rate as a means of paying for it is something that they all are defensive about.
Yeah.
But, they freely admit that. And what is, again, gratifying from my perspective is that you hear Republican mayors, Republican county executives, Republican governors all say we desperately need this, as they did with the American Rescue Plan. So right now, congressional Republicans are the only people who are on the other side of the issue. And I think they're just out on a limb with a lot of people with saws behind them waiting to cut it off.
Well, politically, right? That's what I question. Politically, if there's a opening for a new bridge, they'll want to be there at the ribbon cutting, right?
But
they're voting against it.
Right. We have a project that is desperately needed, not just in Kentucky, and it's not in my district, but throughout that part of the country, a bridge that goes across the Ohio at Cincinnati. It's called the Brent Spence Bridge. It is in very serious danger. As a matter of fact, Barack Obama made a trip there while he was president to talk about the need to do something about that bridge. And this is, it's two Republican states. We have a Democratic governor, but it's a Republican state. Heavily Republican districts on either side of the river, but they desperately need it. But more than that, this is I-75 corridor. It's the I-71 corridor. This is one of the major commerce routes and highways in the country, and this is the type of project that the American Jobs Act will help get done. And it's, again, desperately needed. Republicans are crying for it. And it's amazing to hear Republicans in Congress. And Steve Chabot's the Republican congressman from Cincinnati. I haven't really heard him specifically on it, but it'll be interesting to see what he and Portman and Thomas Massey, who's the congressman on my side of the river, how they regard this project. Because the citizens desperately need it.
Do you think some of them may come around, given pressure from some of their local districts, their mayors or governors?
Well, it didn't matter on the American Rescue Plan, that's for sure. Right. And yep. they were lobbied heavily by their mayors. I think if they take the corporate tax fund, pay for a way, then maybe some of them will change their minds. I think that's going to be the critical decision for some of them, but I still don't think we're going to get many Republicans to vote for it, regardless. Well,
there are enough Democratic votes in the House. If all the Democrats hold together, of course, they can get through the House. The Senate is always the bigger problem. Senator Coons has come forth with a proposal, Congressman, I don't know whether you've seen yet, that he's suggesting that we could split the Jobs Act into the what everybody would agree is infrastructure, right? Like $800 billion worth, and do that as a 60-vote bill, and then do the rest of the stuff, like you mentioned, broadband or electric grid. You and I would argue that that is infrastructure, but if they say it's not, put all of those other things like the child care, the home care for the elderly, in a and do that through reconciliation. Is that a way to go, do you think?
I don't think so, no. I think that's a mistake. That's, you know, it's analogous to the issue of immigration reform. You can do the easy stuff's easy to do on a bipartisan basis. The more difficult stuff's not. So what we would have is, you know, the Republicans would take all the credit for all those ribbon cuttings, as you mentioned, and then they would destroy us for our heavy-handedness in doing Green New Deal projects. I mean, that's exactly what would happen. And I mean, if I were in their shoes, that's the way I would do it. So I just think that that's too convenient for Republicans, and it puts us at a real disadvantage in terms of messaging.
You know, it's interesting. I hadn't intended to ask you about this, but you reminded me. You used the phrase immigration reform. It wasn't that long ago, Congressman, you were part of the Gang of 15 or whatever it was called.
It was the Gang of Eight.
Gang of Eight in the House on immigration reform. Right. Nobody talks about that anymore.
No, and it's sad. You know, going back then, we were, the Senate actually passed a bipartisan bill in the spring of 2013. I think there were 17 or 18 Republicans who voted for it. We had come to an agreement after 7 months of negotiation. And in the Gang of Eight, we were confident that we had a bill that would pass the House with 250 or 60 votes. And we couldn't get John Boehner to bring it to the floor. And it's a tragedy because much of what we're experiencing today would have been solved, again, almost 8 years ago if he had done that. And at the time, this is meaningless history now, but Bob Goodlatte was chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, and Bob was very much opposed to comprehensive immigration reform because he had watched Eric Cantor, the then majority leader, lose his seat in the primary over immigration, and at least that was the narrative. And so he was paranoid about doing anything with immigration, but John Boehner would not go around him. And again, that's very unfortunate because we had a bill we knew could pass, and we knew that it was something that could that we could conference relatively easily because we crafted it in a way that we knew it would satisfy the Senate as well. So it's too bad, but again, the thought then was there's certain parts of immigration reform that are really easy, and there's some that are really hard, and that's why you don't separate them.
Right. One final question on the corporate tax. As you mentioned, the Republicans have basically said, no way, no how are we going to support any increase in taxes. But isn't it a catch-22, Congressman? Because if you said, okay, well, then we'll just add this borrow, right, and add to the deficit, then they're against that too, right?
Exactly.
Right. So
exactly. Yeah, it doesn't concern me that if we were – of all the things we could spend money on and not pay for it, infrastructure is the best thing to do because it does pay for itself over time. And, you know, the most every analysis says that that every dollar spent on infrastructure returns $1.50. More importantly than that, it provides a foundation for the economy of the future, and we desperately need to do that. So I'm fine doing it without having a pay for. I think there are probably too many Democrats who would not agree with me on that. And so I'm not sure we could do it that way. But the question of the corporate tax rate, you know, in any sense of equity, you look at a company like Amazon, made $30 billion in profit. They paid 1.2% federal tax last year, zero the 2 years before that. Their entire business is predicated on infrastructure. FedEx, I don't think, paid any federal tax. Their entire business is infrastructure. So to ask these corporations to, by the way, pay a rate that they would have been thrilled with in 2017 is not so much of a burden. And the executives I've talked to aren't really concerned about that. They say, yeah, take us to 25, take us to 28. It's fine. We'll deal with it. And they didn't ask for 21% in 2017, by the way. The corporations didn't.
Right. I mean, it's not like they're paying anywhere close to 21%, right? Or 28%.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Yeah. And, you know, the Republicans say, well, this will hurt small businesses. Well, that's nonsense because small businesses don't pay corporate tax. The vast majority of them are what's called subchapter S corporation, and the profits pass through to them as individuals, and they pay at individual rates. So this wouldn't have any impact on the vast majority of small businesses.
Is the bottom line here that the really basis for the opposition is they just don't want Joe Biden to accomplish anything, just like
well, of
they
course.
Didn't? Okay, I just might as well thought I'd just put that out there.
Yeah, of course that's the bottom line. And you know, again, maybe they don't believe in polls, but you look at every poll out there and they're swimming upstream against public opinion. That's for sure.
For sure. On the tax question, Congressman, one thing that is not in the president's plan is something that's been talked about a lot, and that is the so-called SALT issue, right? The state and local tax exemption thing that Donald Trump did away with. Any chance of that coming back?
I don't know. There's not unanimity among Democrats to do away with the SALT deduction, and because
it's pretty popular among the American people, right? I
mean, it's pretty popular among the American people. It does. It is kind of the
provision. I always liked it.
Well, I mean, I won't say it's killing me, but it's certainly doing away with the SALT deduction is certainly affecting me in a negative way. And because we have a property tax in Kentucky and we have a state income tax, and I have too much real estate and I'm paying a lot of property taxes and I can only deduct a small percentage of that. So, but, you know, it is a regressive proposition because the deduction does disproportionately affect wealthier people. Mm-hmm. So true liberals should say, and many of them do, don't do away with it. But then you have a lot of true liberals in New York and California who are adversely affected by eliminating the deduction, and they're kind of torn.
So the answer may be a cap as to how much.
I mean, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine. I will not name him, but he's been a friend of mine for most of my life, and he's a very, very high placed financial world in New York. And he said the people I know are much more concerned about the SALT deduction than they are about tax rates. He said you can increase their top marginal rate on their income, you can put the SALT deduction back in. But, I mean, you can raise the corporate tax, but the SALT deduction is the biggest killer for them.
Interesting. Right. Congressman, we'll take a quick break here. And a couple of other issues I want to ask you about. Again, good for you to spend some time with us. We're talking to Congressman John Yarmuth from Kentucky's 3rd Congressional District, also chair of the House Budget Committee. We'll be right back. And today's podcast brought to you by the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. 1.3 million members strong, the good men and women of the UFCW under Mark Perrone. They're the ones who serve us so well in our big retail stores, the big grocery chains, our meat and poultry processing plants, cannabis factories, and chemical factories, all on the front lines every day in this era of COVID. We salute the members of the UFCW. thank them for their support of the Bill Press Pod, direct you to their website for more information at ufcw.org.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And we're back with Congressman John Yarmuth from Kentucky, chair of the House Budget Committee. Congressman, I got to ask you, okay, you're from Kentucky, and there's another pretty prominent member of the Congress who is from Kentucky as well. And the in a new book out by Susan Page, who is the Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today, about Speaker Pelosi. Speaker Pelosi says of Mitch McConnell, quote, "He is not a force for good in our country. He is an enabler of the worst stuff and an instigator of some of it on his own." You know Mitch McConnell well. Accurate description?
Yeah, I think it's pretty close. I would certainly not differ with the speaker on that. You know, I've known Mitch for a long time, over 50 years, and Mitch is a 100% political animal. You and I have talked about this on a number of occasions. I once said about him in an interview that he, every day since he was 5 years old, has awakened every morning, and the first thing he thinks about is, what do I do today to enhance my political power? And that's really all that's ever driven him. And, you know, he's committed to, I think he feigns that he is committed to principles, but he's not. He's only committed to power. So, you know, his legacy, which he says his legacy is having packed the federal court system with conservative justices. The problem is he has no end in mind for that. That wasn't a policy outcome that he was seeking with conservative judges. It was just an electoral issue. And that's the way he sees everything, as an electoral issue. And that's a dangerous thing to have in a person who is running the Senate, who has right now minority veto power. And that's pride, concerning.
And prides himself on not accomplishing anything or not getting anything done. I mean, he loves the phrase Grim Reaper.
The Grim Reaper, I don't know. I haven't really I haven't researched his voting record over his 36 years. I think this is his 37th year. But I think you could put the number of bills with his name on it, and you could count them on one hand, and none of them have been anything significant because he doesn't care about policy. Mm-hmm. He just never has. At one time, he cared about, he had a sincere belief in First Amendment, and like he originally opposed flag burning amendments because he thought that was a violation of the First Amendment. He's changed on that, as a matter of fact, because that became uncomfortable with the Republican base. But he's never really wanted to accomplish anything except, again, maintain power. And what he did in the last Congress, we passed about 400 bills that sat on his desk. The vast majority of them were bipartisan bills. And he didn't want to put them on the floor because he wanted to protect his members from taking difficult votes, mm-hmm. although a lot of them weren't difficult votes, but some of them were. And that's all he's concerned about, is maintaining his majority and his power. What's interesting, Bill, is I wrote an op-ed a few weeks ago about the filibuster. And I said in the article that if we did away with the filibuster, that would be Mitch McConnell's kryptonite because he would lose all of his power. Now, I have said all sorts of critical things about Mitch McConnell over the 14 plus mm-hmm. years I've been in Congress. I've called him a liar on national television and gone from there. He's never, ever reacted to anything I said about him until that.
No kidding.
A few days later, he had an op-ed in the Louisville Courier Journal, in which he basically did everything but argue my position. It was mostly taking shots at me, saying, well, if I didn't like the way the Senate operated, I should run against him. And I said, you know, like, I don't want to represent the rest of Kentucky. I'm sorry. It just wouldn't be comfortable for me. But it was fascinating because I hit a nerve. And
yeah, you finally got under his skin.
I got under his skin.
Well, but here's somebody who did not get under his skin. And I want to ask you about, I don't understand it. So last Saturday at the Republican donors meeting at Mar-a-Lago, Donald Trump called Mitch McConnell a dumb son of a bitch and attacked his wife for being a coward, basically, and quitting her job after the attack on the Capitol on January 6th. And Mitch McConnell never said one word.
I know.
Why?
It's interesting.
How could you?
It's interesting. You know, well, one thing I would say, I won't comment on the SOB part of that comment, but he certainly isn't dumb. I mean, right. Anybody is making a mistake if they call Mitch dumb. But, you know, Elaine Chao was, I think she was kind of the only one of the longest serving cabinet members. She served all but the last few weeks of the Trump administration. Yeah. She was as loyal as anybody could be for Trump to take her on at that point was really cruel and unfounded. But you're right. I mean, Mitch understands, just like most of the Republicans do, that if they want to take the majority back in the Senate in 2022, that they can't afford to be on Trump's bad side. And
so they even put up with that.
Yeah. Right. Well, it's just like Ted Cruz putting up with all the nasty comments that
Trump made
about his wife.
And father. Yeah.
And father. Yeah.
So the last time I saw you, Congressman, in our studio on the Bill Press Show, you were proudly wearing an F on your lapel.
Yeah, still do.
And the F, just so all of our listeners understand, stands for?
It is my rating from the National Rifle Association.
Which I
proudly wear.
Right.
And have for the last 2.5 years.
So is the NRA, which is now a bankrupt organization, which its leader, Wayne LaPierre, in court trying to defend his actions to basically steal money from the organization, mm-hmm. are they still as powerful as they once were?
Well, you have to qualify that statement. They're not nearly as powerful overall, but they are still influential with many members. And as I always say, people would always say, how can, you know, you have 90% support in the country for universal background checks and members still don't want to vote for that. And I say, the problem is not the 90%. The problem is of the remaining 10%, there are 2 or 3% for whom that is their primary voting issue. They're a one-issue voter. And these members worry about losing 1,000 or 2,000 or 4,000 votes in their district if they were to, to do something the NRA doesn't like. So that's been the most frustrating, one of the most frustrating aspects of this job for so many years is it's just that concern about a couple thousand votes here and there. And if you're in a marginal district, you do worry about that. You know, people say, oh, you're really courageous to vote against the NRA in Kentucky. I said, no, I'm not courageous at all. I said, there may be a couple thousand voters in my district who will vote against me because of the gun, my gun position. But by the way, they're never going to vote for a Democrat anyway. So my position doesn't move any voters. And that's kind of the way a lot of politicians think about these issues. And a lot of people, and I had a Democratic colleague of mine was one of them back a few years ago who said, I have to have an A rating from the NRA. I just have to. And whether that's true or not, I don't know, but that there are a lot of members who feel that way. Now, the NRA, I think because of what we did with wearing the F-pins around and we all got, everybody who did it got great reaction from on social media. The NRA has taken the rating system off their website. And when they did it, they said, we did it because our enemies are using them against us. So right. I considered that a victory, but, you know, it's really frustrating that, you know, that something with that degree of public support cannot achieve what it's trying to do.
But it does mean that President Biden will have a very tough time getting any gun safety measures, no matter how strongly he supports them, through this Congress.
Maybe. But the other side of that is, and I think Schumer's going to do this, I think he's going to put that bill on the floor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And once he puts it on the floor, there are going to be some Republicans who are going to have to do some real deep thinking about whether they how they vote, because Mitch has protected them from that vote, and now they won't be protected.
Right. So finally, Congressman, you know, who says that bipartisanship is dead? I know where one place where bipartisanship exists, and that is in the Congressional Bourbon Caucus. You and a friendly Republican are co-chairs of the Congressional Bourbon Caucus. So I'm sure now, you know, a lot of the industries have suffered because of the pandemic. How's the pandemic affected the bourbon industry?
Well, it's been good and it's been bad. Obviously, they're in-store dining, you know, the dining, the bars, the restaurants.
That
consumption has dropped by a huge percentage. So they've lost that. They've actually done very well on the packaging side. So people going into liquor stores and buying bottles and drinking them at home. So that side's been way up. The other side has been way down.
Mm-hmm.
So they're doing fine. The biggest threat to bourbon right now is the tariff that the European Union has put on bourbon, and that it's now 25%. It's actually in a hiatus. They've suspended it, but if nothing happens, it'll go to 50% on June 1st. And the distillers are, you know, they figure they're pretty much saturated the market here. They've achieved as much penetration as they can in the U.S. Their real opportunities for growth have been overseas, but a 50% tariff in the European Union and the U.K. would basically eliminate the export business. So we're pushing back on with the administration, trying to get them to negotiate the end of that. The bourbon tariff had absolutely nothing to do with any of the disputes. It was basically an attempt by the EU to put pressure on Mitch McConnell. because
Kentucky.
Yeah, because distilled spirits had gone back and forth to Europe, United States with no tariffs for years, and everybody was happy with that. But the EU, because of the steel and aluminum tariffs, they decided to put pressure on Mitch. So it's unfortunate, and we had a bipartisan letter, 50 members of the House, almost equally Republican and Democrat, writing to our trade representative, Ambassador Tai, to push her to to resolve this before June 1st. So either
with your co-chair of the Congressional Caucus hat on or with your consumer hat on, Congressman, do you have any tips for best bourbon you might recommend if somebody was going out to get a, you know, a little?
Oh, well, so
for this weekend?
I do it. My default bourbon is Woodford Reserve or Buffalo Trace. Old Forester is also a very good value. So those are the ones that I prefer. The other way I answer that question is if I had one drink of bourbon left in my life, what would it be? And it's Elijah Craig, 23-year-old. And I'll tell a quick story. On Trump's inauguration at 5, I didn't go to the inauguration, but I stayed at home and watched it. My wife and I were there. And at 12:05, I said, you know, we need to toast the last minutes of the Obama administration because the next 4 years are going to be really stressful. So we broke out a bottle of Elijah Craig, 23-year-old.
Oh, man. And
that's what we did. Here's the other tip I have, Bill, that, you know, the Kentucky Derby's coming up in a couple of weeks, 2 weeks from Saturday. And there's a horse who won the Wood Memorial at 72-1. It's going to run in the Derby called Bourbonic.
Oh, Bourbonic, huh?
Yeah. Bourbonic. So mm-hmm. I guarantee you I will be betting on Bourbonic.
All right. There you go. Well, and I think a lot of other people will be now.
That's right.
Congressman John Yarmuth, good to catch up with you on many, many fronts, Congressman. Thanks so much for your good work on behalf of the people of Kentucky and the people of the United States. And we'll talk again soon.
Okay, Bill. Great to be with you. Take care.
And that's it for today's episode of the Bill Press Pod. Thank you so much for joining us. Remember, we've made a lot of progress, but we're not out of the woods yet. Now, everybody is qualified to get the vaccine. They're 16 and older, so no excuses. Go out and do that as soon as you can if you haven't already done so. And meanwhile, continue to wear that mask, practice your social distancing. Keep yourself safe and strong until we see you on the next edition of the Bill Press Pod.